for Saturday, June 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region. Each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. Now, let's take a look at today's weather. The AccuWeather forecast says a storm passing off to the south will bring a few storms to the area today. Most of these will be in the afternoon and continue into the evening, remaining unsettled for tomorrow. Today's anticipated high is 86 degrees with a low of 69 degrees. On Sunday, it's expected to be 88 and low of 74. Sunrise today at 5:43 a.m. Sunset tonight at 8:53 p.m. Moonrise today at 12:23 p.m. And moonset today at 12:57 a.m. Here's the first story from the front page of today's Des Moines Register, and it's entitled, Iowa Will Not Require Face Masks When School Resumes. It's written by Charles Flesher of the Des Moines Register. Jill Pennington Swanson is considering homeschooling her children this fall if students and teachers are not required to wear face coverings in the classroom. The Waukee mother of six said she is disappointed that Iowa is not taking more stringent safety precautions to prevent the spread of coronavirus in schools. It really just seems like business as usual, she said. The Iowa education officials released guidelines Thursday that will allow schools to reopen to normal activities without requirements that students and teachers wear face coverings, undergo temperature checks at the door, or observe social distancing in schools. Instead, the state will leave those decisions in the hands of local school boards, which could lead to a variety of approaches across Iowa's 327 school districts and 119 accredited non-public schools. Officials at Des Moines Public Schools said this week that they would require students and teachers to wear face masks in buildings. Ankeny, on the other hand, will not require face masks or temperature checks when school resumes. The majority of Des Moines area school district officials that spoke with the Register said those decisions are still being worked out, and it could be weeks before parents know what will happen when school starts. It would just be nice to know what they're thinking, Pennington Swanson said. I know August is a ways off, but for planning, it would be nice to know what direction they are leaning. Late Friday afternoon, the Department of Education released a statement saying further clarification of guidelines is needed. It promised to release additional information in the near future. We recognize that face masks can be an important tool to help mitigate the spread of the coronavirus, the statement said. The Department of Education and the Iowa Department of Public Health have not recommended a mask requirement for all students and staff because of the considerable implications for such a policy. However, schools may require masks if they choose. Jean Hesburgh, a spokeswoman for the Iowa State Education Association, the State Teachers Union, said the state's plan doesn't comply with the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control guidelines for public places. It is a gamble and obscene that the governor and the Department of Education are gambling on the health and safety of our students, our staff, and school employees, Hesburgh said. This virus has demonstrated that it knows no bounds, and students can bring the virus home to families and ravage a family. ISEA President Mike Baranek released a statement Thursday urging school districts to create their own guidelines mandating face coverings, physical distancing, and other safety protocols. The union represents more than 50,000 teachers and other education professionals. I simply don't understand why the state of Iowa is not taking a cue from what is happening in our country and implementing guidelines that are scientifically proven and recommended by our health specialists all throughout our country, he said. The CDC recommends wearing cloth face coverings in public settings where other social distancing measures are difficult to maintain. Iowa Department of Education spokeswoman Heather Doe said the guidance was created with the Iowa Department of Public Health. She said local districts may require stricter measures based on local circumstances. The health and safety of students, families, administrators, teachers, and school staff will continue to be our number one priority, and we will continue to rely on public health experts to inform all decisions made, she said. The recommendations come as states across the country grapple with how to reopen schools during the largest pandemic to hit the United States in a generation. Illinois announced this week that it would require all students and teachers to wear face coverings and practice social distancing inside school buildings this fall. Districts will be required to conduct temperature checks or require self-certification that individuals entering school buildings are symptom-free. Danielle Imhoff, a mother of two daughters, said she is glad to see the state leave the decision up to local school districts. She lives in the eastern Iowa town of Keota, population 1,000, where she said few people wear face coverings. I personally spoke to our superintendent this week and a couple of our school board members and just expressed that I would appreciate if they left it to be an individual decision, she said. Her oldest daughter, a sophomore at Mount Mercy College in Cedar Rapids, has underlying medical conditions that put her at risk for COVID-19. The college will require her and other students to wear face coverings when they return to campus this fall. Her youngest daughter will be a senior at Keota High School next year in a class of 29 students. I have a child with an underlying condition, and I still have this position, Imhoff said. My parents both wear masks, and that's fine, but I don't feel my wearing a mask or not wearing a mask is endangering someone else. Michelle Yartz, a mother of two Des Moines Public School students, said the state is not providing enough direction to school districts. She is considering homeschooling this fall if the district does not implement stricter rules to prevent the spread of the virus. My daughter goes to Central Academy, and she was taking Japanese, and now I have to figure out how to try to give her the same quality education from home, she said. I'm not a teacher. It's just a horrible position to be in. Swanson, the Waukee mother of six, was in a similar spot last spring when the governor closed schools for the remainder of the academic year. She purchased an online curriculum and began teaching her children at home. We're lucky that I have the ability to do that, the stay-at-home mother said. I know not everybody is that fortunate. Yartz said she'd like to see Des Moines Public Schools reduce the number of students in buildings next fall to allow for more social distancing in classrooms. That's one approach the district is considering. The Des Moines School Board met with administrators Tuesday to discuss reopening schools this fall. The district expects to implement a hybrid approach that would include both in-person and virtual classes. Students would also have the option to take 100% of their classes in a virtual setting. For those who choose to return to school buildings, the district said it plans to reduce class sizes to adhere to social distancing recommendations. Des Moines is still working out details, and a finalized plan has not yet been approved. School districts have until July 1st to submit return to learn plans to the Iowa Department of Education, which include commitments to provide both in-person and virtual learning options. However, schools are not required to address how they plan to handle issues like face coverings and social distancing. Jennifer Yuli Wells, West Des Moines School Board Vice President, said the district has been working on its plan since the spring. Like many other districts, it is surveying parents to get their input on safety issues. "I don't know that we can take a one-size-fits-all approach," Yuli Wells said. "We will be continuing to get the latest information from the CDC, Iowa Department of Public Health, and Polk County Public Health to make the best decisions for our staff and our families." She said the district expects to provide more guidance to families early next month. The Iowa Department of Education has made no public announcement on the guidelines, and Reynolds made no mention of it at a Thursday news conference during which she extended an earlier coronavirus-related emergency proclamation, but allowed school-related sports activities to resume. The guidance was posted on the department's website in preparation for the school year, which for most schools occurs in mid or late August. The guidance calls for staff or students who are sick to remain home, but doesn't require temperature check or any other health screening before entering the schools, saying it's not a CDC recommendation because one symptom is not necessarily indicative of communicable disease. Students and staff should be allowed to use personal face coverings if they choose, the guidance reads, and students should be taught not to criticize the use or non-use of facial coverings. Schools should provide appropriate personal protective equipment and training for employees who have a medium to high risk of exposure or as determined by their job-related task, the advisory said. Schools may not be able to guarantee that physical distancing can be met in all school settings throughout the entire school day, during school activities, or with transportation, the document said. Schools are to post signs on how to stop the spread of illness and have routine cleaning practices of facilities, high-touch surface areas, cafeterias, concession stands, health offices, and buses, following CDC guidance and any state or federal sanitation regulations. Our next article is entitled, "Nearly 100 Naturalized in Parking Lot Ceremony." This is by Maya Miller and Victoria Yin of the Des Moines Register. The annual citizenship ceremony at Principal Park looked a little different this year. Since the year 2009, U.S. Senior District Judge Robert Pratt has sworn in new citizens on the field before an Iowa Cubs game sometime around the 4th of July. Post-game fireworks would punctuate the evening. "It's the perfect day to be sworn in," teen owner Michael Gartner said. "What's better than the 4th of July, baseball, hot dogs, and citizenship?" There's no holiday baseball this year, since the minor league baseball season has been indefinitely delayed because of the coronavirus pandemic. There are no hot dogs, since the Cubs temporarily suspended operations at the park after a team employee tested positive for the illness. There is no Judge Pratt, who was advised not to attend after the team employee's diagnosis. And no fireworks. Instead, Penny Luthens, deputy clerk of the U.S. District Court, administered the Oath of Allegiance in the parking lot outside Principal Park to 98 new U.S. citizens. They represented 33 different countries, including the African nation of Brunei, from which Benito Dayashimi hails. "Becoming a citizen was really the best thing that could happen to me," Dayashimi said after the ceremony. Dayashimi, age 21, moved to Des Moines in the year 2007 and has spent the past 10 years working towards citizenship. The Iowa State student said, "It is a privilege to live in a country that values freedom and democracy." He said the U.S. has already provided many opportunities for him to succeed. While some Americans believe democracy is under attack, Dayashimi said he has faith in young people he thinks will change the country for the better. I see hope in the next generation, Daishimi said. Considering what's going on right now in this country, the young people are the ones who are on the front lines fighting for what is right. The future is being shaped by the young generation. The Iowa Cubs first hosted a citizenship ceremony in the year 2009. It is now an annual event with 327 new citizens welcomed during the first 11 years. Between Friday's event and new drive-up appointments each day this week, 487 people completed the naturalization process. Here are some of their stories. Hung Harvey, age 26, Vietnam. When she was 20 years old, Harvey emigrated from Vietnam to Iowa City to join her uncle and other family members. That was 6 years ago. She now lives in Mount Pleasant and works as a nail technician at Magic Nails Salon and Spa. She said her greatest challenge was learning and improving her English when she first came to the States. She was motivated to become a naturalized citizen because of greater political freedoms. Harvey lives with her parents and six-year-old daughter, who joined her at the ceremony. Sarah Reyes, age 20, United Arab Emirates. Reyes, who is Sudanese, first moved to Iowa City in 2015 to attend the University of Iowa, and she graduated last fall with a degree in English. She said the biggest challenge she faced when moving to the U.S. was adjusting to its culture. She could already speak English when she arrived, but she said learning to navigate an individualistic society and depend on herself was difficult. I'm used to a more collectivist culture, Reyes said. She and her family still live in Iowa City, and she will begin law school at the University of Iowa this fall. A sidebar to this article, there is no single American way to think or believe. Although U.S. Senior District Judge Robert Pratt could not welcome the citizens in person this year, he provided a copy of his remarks to the Register. Below is an excerpt that he includes every year. Now I wish to speak to you as United States citizens, which you now are. You may hear voices in this land that say there is only one true American religion. Do not believe it. As an American, you may freely and openly be Christian, a Jew, a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Muslim, or you may adhere to any other religion, or you may be an agnostic or an atheist. You may hear voices in this land that say that there is only one true American way to think and believe about political matters, economic matters, and social matters. Do not believe it. As an American, you may freely and openly adhere to political, economic, and social views on the right, on the left, or anywhere in between. You may hear voices in this land that say there is only one true American set of values. Do not believe it. As an American, you may openly hold beliefs and values greatly different from those of others, even if those of others are shared by many and yours are shared by few. Simply stated, there is no single American way to think or believe. Indeed, conformity of thought and belief would be contrary to the underlying principles of this great nation. First article on the Metro in Iowa page is entitled Reynolds Signs Law Restricting Secretary of State's Powers. It's written by Ian Richardson of the Des Moines Register. Governor Kim Reynolds has signed into law new restrictions that will prevent Secretary of State Paul Pate from mailing ballot request forms to Iowans in November's election without first seeking approval from legislators. The law will also prohibit county election officials from decreasing the number of polling places by more than 35% during an election. The legislation was passed by state lawmakers after Pate and county election officials took similar steps before the primary because of the coronavirus pandemic. Leading up to the primary, Pate extended the mail-in voting period from 29 to 40 days and mailed ballot request forms to every registered voter in Iowa. The primary had record turnout, with nearly 80% of those casting ballots voting absentee. But Republicans in both chambers of the legislature took looked to limit Pate's power, with some saying he had pushed the limits of his authority and that another Secretary of State could use the same powers in an effort to reduce voter turnout. Reynolds and Pate's offices did not immediately respond to a request for comment Thursday evening. Republicans in the Senate had originally proposed a much more wide-ranging bill that would have prevented Pate entirely from unilaterally mailing out ballot request forms, but Republicans and Democrats in the House compromised to instead require that any action Pate wanted to take to alter election procedures receive approval from Legislative Council, a group of lawmakers made up of leadership and long-serving members of both parties in the House and Senate. The modified bill passed the House 95-2 and the Senate by a 31-16 margin. Many Senate Democrats accused Republicans of attempting to suppress the vote in the upcoming general election. Reynolds did not comment publicly on the law while it was making its way through the legislative process, but she had previously said she was fine with Pate's actions during the primary. She signed the bill into law Thursday. The law comes as some health experts expect coronavirus activity to continue to be an issue for the general election in the fall. Des Moines venues taking cautious stance for welcoming back crowds. This comes to us from Sierra A. Porter of the Des Moines Register. As Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds continues lowering barriers to the resumption of business as usual, the gateway is opening for shows at the Des Moines Metro's major concert venues. It's not clear, though, whether those performances will start ramping up. Major concerts by the likes of Elton John, Cher, and this week Luke Bryan at the Wells Fargo Arena all either have been postponed or canceled. At least one venue, Brenton Skating Plaza in the East Village, announced this week it was closing for the season because of the pandemic, and the operators of some venues say the social distancing requirements still in place don't allow them enough room to operate normally. Other concert halls and amphitheaters say they're ready to welcome artists back, as have some smaller venues, most notably Woolies in the East Village. But few have anything definitively scheduled. Most say it's up to the performers to decide when they're ready to hit the road again. So what does Des Moines' major venues have planned? Lauridsen Amphitheater at Waterworks Park. The outdoor venue is the first major event. Was supposed to be a concert by Blues Traveler and J.J. Gray on August the 9th, but on Friday it was postponed to a date to be named in 2021. Still on, though, is the Buttercow Festival, a music, food, and beer gathering August 14th and 15th. Sam Carell, executive director at the Waterworks Park Foundation, said because concert goers can spread out across the lawn, there will be plenty of room to maintain social distancing, at least for smaller shows. Some type of events allow for it, others are more challenging, Carell said. Having thousands of people bunched up in front of a stage for a typical concert setting probably isn't a safe approach, but smaller events spread out or presenting larger events where the layout allows for social distancing to be maintained seems more viable. For example, the organizers of the Buttercow Festival plan to sell blocks of tickets so that up to 8 people can sit together in marked off 15 by 15 foot boxes. Attendees can have their box, can leave their box, excuse me, but it will serve as their personal space for the event. Brenton Skating Plaza, just a week ago, Brenton Skating Plaza pulled the plug on most of its Nightfall on the River concert series, but held out hope of perhaps salvaging some shows late in the season under its signature canopy. However, it now is shutting down for the rest of the season. We took all factors into account on whether it made sense for us to install the canopy and decided, given the uncertainty of future guidelines, that it made the most sense to cancel events for 2020, Amy Lego, Executive Director of Operation Downtown, said this week. We have been in communication with those who booked the venue to provide them with a full refund. Des Moines Performing Arts. Des Moines Performing Arts, which operates the Des Moines Civic Center, Temple and Stoner Theaters, and Cowles Common, said in a statement this week that although capacity restrictions have loosened, touring engagements have not resumed operations. It also said that a vast majority of the group's primary programming cannot operate within the parameters needed to ensure proper social distancing. The safety and well-being of our audiences, artists, and staff is always our top priority. While we do not know our exact reopening date, our team is working diligently to welcome the community back to our venues, the statement said. Hoyt Sherman Place, the ornate but intimate concert hall in Sherman Hill, faces the same challenges as Des Moines Performing Arts. Until social distancing rules are lifted, we cannot hold a live event in the theater, Hoyt Sherman Place's executive director, Robert Warren, said in a statement to the Des Moines Register. Iowa Event Center. Des Moines' biggest concert venue, Wells Fargo Arena, continues to list scheduled performances on its website, including ones by comedian ventriloquist Jeff Dunham on July 30th, country music star Alan Jackson on September 11th, and Cher in her rescheduled appearance on September 28th. But none of those events is a sure thing, acknowledged Adam Flack, the Iowa Event Center's marketing director. Some artists are eager to get back on the road. Rocker Sammy Hagar told Mediate this week that I'd rather personally get sick and even die if that's what it takes to resume performing. Others have taken a more cautious approach. Jackson, for example, kicked off a drive-in tour June 13th in Alabama, where he performs for people who remain in their parked cars in an open field. Artists may also face logistical problems. For instance, a tour that had been routed to include closely spaced stops in neighboring states such as Iowa and Illinois now faces a radically different set of requirements. Iowa has no limit on capacity so long as social distancing is maintained, while Illinois only allows outdoor concerts at 1/5 capacity. When performances do resume, Spectra, the operator of the Iowa Event Center, which also includes Hy-Vee Hall and Community Choice Credit Union Convention Center, say it has a playbook of practices, policies, and procedures for each venue in place. Last weekend, Hy-Vee Hall was the site of a talent contest where dance troupes had the option of either sending in a video of their performance for scoring or appearing on site to perform in front of judges. Signs explaining required coronavirus precautions were posted at doors, restrooms, elevators, and escalators, and also in the event space, Event Center staff said. We want our guests and our employees alike to know their health and safety is our top priority, and we're taking every measure possible to ensure they have a safe experience, Chris Connolly, Spectra's general manager at the Iowa Event Center, said in a news release. And Franklin Junior High. Franklin Junior High, which was just getting ready to open as the second largest performance venue in the Des Moines metro area when the coronavirus pandemic hit, will host a church event sometime in July with about 240 people in the smaller of its two auditoriums. We're fortunate that we have a 650-seat auditorium and 4,500-seat auditorium. So for almost all of the events, they'll be held in the big auditorium so that social distancing or physical distancing won't be an issue, said the venue's developer, Jeff Young. Young said that when larger scale performances kick in, seating in the larger auditorium, originally built as a sanctuary for a megachurch that formerly owned the school property, will be limited to 3 per pew, the lengths of which range from 14 feet to almost 24 feet. Safety guidelines will vary depending on the number of people expected at each event. We have over 15 different entrance points to the big auditorium, Young said. Because the venue is so large, the ability for us to keep separation is easy. Here's the latest COVID numbers in Iowa. As of 10 a.m. Friday, the state of Iowa was reporting 7 additional COVID-19 deaths and an additional 493 confirmed cases since the state's tally from 10 a.m. Thursday. Total cases confirmed, 27,555. Total deaths, 701. Total recovered, 17,140. And total tested, 282,013. The ALR says dozens of cats rescued from Iowa home. This article is written by Philip Jones. One cat died and 58 were rescued Wednesday from a Mitchell County home, according to the Animal Rescue League of Iowa. Cats ranged in age from kittens to adults, according to the ARL. Rescuers found urine and feces all over the home, ARL spokeswoman Stephanie Filer said in a news release. All cats in the home had fleas and mites, Filer said. In a news release, some had respiratory infections and ringworm. One dehydrated cat died shortly after rescuers arrived, Filer said in the release. The cats are currently being treated at the ARL's Des Moines shelter. Law enforcement is treating the case as a cat hoarding case, Filer said. Last year, the ARL of Iowa rescued about 300 cats from Iowa homes. This year, the ARL has rescued 132 cats from Iowa homes, Filer said. And police say man used pit bull to attack partiers. This is written by Phillips Jones as well. An Ankeny man was arrested Thursday after using a pit bull to attack people at a party, then stabbing the dog to death as it attacked him, according to police. Around 2:25 a.m. June 6th, Juan Carlos Moreno Martinez, age 33, agitated a pit bull in an attempt to intimidate partygoers at a home in the 500 block of Northeast Delaware Avenue in Ankeny, according to court documents. Three people were injured by the pit bull, including one seriously injured, according to records. Martinez was then attacked by the pit bull and stabbed the dog several times in the head and neck, killing it, according to court records. He was charged with 3 counts of assault and 1 count of animal neglect, a felony, according to court records. Martinez was being held at the Polk County Jail. And Donnell Eller writes the next article entitled, Newly Unemployed Iowa Workers Will Get a Small Boost. Newly unemployed Iowa workers will get a small increase in their compensation checks, Iowa Workforce Development said Friday. The boost applies to workers who file new unemployment insurance claims for the week beginning July the 5th. The maximum increase, which varies according to the number of dependents a worker claims, ranges from $12 to $14 a week, the state agency's data show. For example, a worker with no dependents will receive a maximum of $493 each week, $12 more than the current amount. A worker with 4 or more dependents will get a maximum benefit of $605 or $14 more each week. The state says about half of Iowans eligible for unemployment insurance qualify for the maximum benefit. Workers now receiving benefits from state or federal programs do not qualify for the increase and will continue to receive the same amount, Iowa Workforce Development said. Iowa Workforce Development also announced it was increasing benefits for people idled on or after July 1st by the on-the-job injuries. The maximum weekly compensation for temporary total disability, healing period, permanent total disability, and death will rise to $1,864. For permanent partial disability, the weekly maximum will be $1,715, the state said. It did not respond to a reporter's request for the current amounts. The increase was triggered by a boost in the amount of wages covered by the unemployment insurance program, Iowa Workforce Development said. That brings us to an article entitled, Families of Three Workers Who Died Sue Tyson Over Outbreak. It's written by Ryan J. Foley of the Associated Press. The families of three workers who died after contracting the coronavirus in an Iowa meat plant outbreak sued Tyson Foods and its top executives Thursday, saying the company knowingly put employees at risk and lied to keep them on the job. The lawsuit alleges that Tyson officials were aware of the virus that was spreading at the Waterloo pork processing plant by late March or early April, but kept that information from employees and the public. As the outbreak grew, the company failed to implement safety measures, allowed some sick and exposed employees to remain on the production line, and falsely assured workers and the public that the plant was safe, the suit alleges. Tyson intended by these false representations to deceive workers in the Waterloo facility and to induce them to continue working despite the uncontrolled COVID-19 outbreak at the plant and the health risks associated with working, according to the lawsuit, which was filed in Blackhawk County District Court. Tyson spokesman Gary Mickelson said the company was saddened by the deaths and that its top priority is the health and safety of our workers. He said Tyson has implemented safety measures that meet or exceed federal guidelines. Meatpacking plants have been hotspots for coronavirus because of their crowded conditions, prompting several to temporarily close. Thousands of workers have become infected and several dozen have died. The largest union representing meatpacking workers said Thursday that more than 14,000 employees at unionized plants have been infected with coronavirus and 65 have died. Meat companies including Smithfield Foods and JBS USA and retailers such as Amazon and Walmart have been sued by the families of workers who died from coronavirus. But the lawsuit filed Thursday against Tyson may be the first involving multiple big victims at one workplace during the pandemic, according to news reports. Last week, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill into law shielding businesses and healthcare providers from legal claims from people exposed to the virus retroactive to January 1st. But the law has exceptions for injuries that result in hospitalization and death and appears unlikely to block the case from moving forward. The lawsuit seeks damages for the estates of employees Sadika Buljic, age 58, who died on April 18th, Roberlano Garcia, age 60, who died on April 23rd, and Jose Ayala Jr., age 44, who died on May 25th. Waterloo attorneys Tom Frericks and John Rausch said the Spence Law Firm in Wyoming are representing the families. At least two other Waterloo workers have died after contracting the virus, which infected more than 1,000 of the plant's 2,800 workers and has devastated the broader community. With illnesses mounting, Tyson refused calls from local leaders to close the plant for several days and lobbied the governor to keep it open, the suit alleges. The county sheriff, who visited the plant April 10th, has said he was shaken by seeing workers in crowded conditions without face coverings and pressed Tyson to close. The plant is Tyson's largest pork facility and can process around 20,000 hogs per day. Iowa's Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspected the plant April 20th in response to complaints and said earlier this month it found no violations. The plant closed 2 days after the inspection before reopening with new safety measures in early May. In addition to damages for pain and suffering and loss of income, the lawsuit seeks punitive damages to punish Tyson for an incorrigible, willful, and wanton disregard for workplace safety and to send a message to other companies. The lawsuit names the company as well as Chairman John H. Tyson, CEO Noel White, spokeswoman Liz Croston, and several other executives and plant supervisors. Its claims include gross negligence and fraudulent misrepresentation. John H. Tyson asserted in a newspaper ad in April that the food supply chain is breaking due to plant closures and warned that customers would see meat shortages at grocery stores. The lawsuit claims those warnings were exaggerated and notes that Tyson's pork exports to China, including some from the Waterloo plant, increased significantly that month. The lawsuit makes an explosive claim that Tyson has denied previously that the company allowed workers and subcontractors from another Iowa plant that had closed due to coronavirus outbreak to begin working in Waterloo in April. Plant supervisors told employees that their sick co-workers had the flu and warned them not to discuss coronavirus at work, the salute alleges. One man who vomited while on the production line was allowed to keep working, it claims. Next, nurse accused of taking drugs from patients sentenced. This also comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids nurse accused of taking painkillers from hospital patients' intravenous lines and injecting herself has been sentenced to 4 months in federal prison. Kelly Postal, age 43, of Anamosa, was sentenced Friday to the prison term and fined $5,500, federal prosecutors said in a news release. She also was ordered to pay restitution for the cost of the drugs stolen and legal fees and forfeit her nursing license. Postal had pleaded guilty in February to 2 counts of acquiring morphine and fentanyl on multiple occasions from October through December of the year 2018. Prosecutors say Postal obtained an excessive amount of fentanyl and morphine from the hospital pharmacy and administered patients prescribed amounts and then injected herself while at work with the leftover drugs. Authorities also say Postal took fentanyl from a patient by using a syringe to withdraw it from an intravenous line and injected herself while still at work. Review says Iowa can take years to decertify officers for crimes. This is written by Ryan J. Foley of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Iowa City. An Iowa agency recently granted more power to remove problem officers has routinely taken years to ban those who commit serious crimes and rarely has sanctioned officers for improper policing alone, a review by the Associated Press shows. The Iowa Law Enforcement Academy Council has sought to decertify 17 officers in the last 2.5 years after determining that they had committed crimes or misconduct that warranted their permanent removal from the profession. The Associated Press review found that most of these officers had been found guilty of felonies, domestic violence, or other crimes that should automatically disqualify them from working in law enforcement under Iowa law. Only one officer since 2018 has been decertified for improper police work alone. A Cedar Rapids patrolman who arrested a man without probable cause and filed false reports. None of the cases reviewed by the Associated Press involved allegations of excessive force or racism against the more than 7,000 certified full-time and reserve officers in the state. In response to protests against police brutality and racial injustice, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed a law this month that expands the types of behavior that require officers to be decertified. The law, for the first time, requires that the council expel officers who engage in serious misconduct, including the repeated use of excessive force and the fabrication of evidence. The council will develop rules defining what type of misconduct may trigger suspension and removal under the new law, Academy Director Judy Bradshaw said. She's also studying how much staff the 13-member council that includes sheriffs, police chiefs, and citizens will need to process cases. The new law also requires departments to report details of misconduct to the council within 10 days of an officer's firing or resignation. seeking to close a gap that has contributed to delays in decertification or missed cases. Representative Raz Smith, a Waterloo Democrat who helped write the new law, said some chiefs have defended problematic officers who use improper force or allowed them to quietly resign. He said the law sends a message that the public wants a harder stance against officers who abuse their power. We're going to have to create a more robust and transparent process for removing officers, he said, and we're going to have to find out why this takes so long. Previously, the law required the council to remove officers for felonies and other specific crimes and gave it some discretion to act against those who were fired or resigned due to misconduct. The council's review process is cloaked in confidentiality. The council does not release information about whether an officer is under investigation for potential decertification. It reviewed cases during closed meetings before voting to dismiss many of them without seeking an unidentified officer's removal or offering any public explanation. Even in cases in which removal is mandatory, the council routinely takes a year or longer to file petitions seeking decertification after an officer has been convicted. A hearing before an administrative law judge and a council vote can take another year before the action is final. Some take far longer. Two recent cases involved misconduct allegations dating to 2011 and 2012 that weren't reported to the state or investigated until this year. Dennis Beadle was sentenced to prison in 2016 for sexual abuse he carried out while working as a reserve officer, but he didn't formally lose the ability to work in the profession until April 2019. A former Tama police chief who pleaded guilty in 2017 to selling vehicles and guns in the department's possession for personal profit wasn't decertified until March of 2020. U.S. House approves bill to make D.C. the 51st state, but Trump and Senate GOP oppose the measure. This is written by Matthew Daly of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. The Democratic-controlled House approved a bill Friday to make the District of Columbia the 51st state, saying Congress has the moral obligation and constitutional authority to ensure that the city's 700,000 residents are allowed full voting rights, no longer subject to taxation without representation. Lawmakers approved the bill 232-180. Largely along party lines, marking the first time a chamber of Congress has passed a D.C. statehood bill. Minnesota Representative Colin Peterson was the sole Democrat to oppose the bill. No Republican voted for it. The legislation now goes to the Republican-controlled Senate, where it faces insurmountable opposition from GOP leaders. Eleanor Holmes Norton, the district's non-voting representative in Congress, sponsored the bill, saying it has the facts and Constitution on its side. D.C.'s population is larger than those of Wyoming and Vermont, and the new state would be one of seven with populations under 1 million, she said. The city's $15.5 billion annual budget is larger than those of 12 states, and D.C.'s AAA bond rating is higher than those of 35 states, Norton said. Opponents, mostly Republicans, called the bill a power grab for the firmly Democratic city and said the nation's founding fathers intended the capital to be separate from the other states. This is about power, make no mistake about it, said Representative Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas. The bill would fundamentally alter what D.C. is, he added. Norton, who has served as D.C. delegate since 1991, said the issue is deeply personal for her and thousands of other city residents who have long been disenfranchised. Her great-grandfather, Richard Holmes, escaped slavery at a Virginia plantation and made it as far as D.C., a walk to freedom, but not to equal citizenship, she said. For three generations, my family has been denied the rights other Americans take for granted. Congress has two choices, she added. It can continue to exercise undemocratic, autocratic authority over the 705,000 American citizens, treating them, in the words of Frederick Douglass, as aliens, not citizens, but subjects. Or Congress can live up to this nation's promise and ideals, end taxation without representation, and pass the statehood bill. The bill would create a new state of Washington, Douglas Commonwealth, in honor of the Virginia-born first president and the Maryland-born abolitionist and former slave. The bill also would reduce the size of the federal district to a tourist-friendly area that includes the White House, the Capitol, the Supreme Court, federal monuments, and the federal executive, legislative, and judicial office buildings adjacent to the National Mall and the Capitol. Congress would retain control of that 2-square-mile area. Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser invoked Douglas as she hailed the historic vote, bringing the city closer than ever to becoming the 51st state. Oxygen is in very short supply. Many countries face shortage amid pandemic. Lori Hinnant, Carly Petch, and Bobakar Diallo of the Associated Press contributed to this article. And the dateline is Conakry, Guinea. Soaring demand for oxygen, prompted by the coronavirus, is bringing out a stark global truth. Even the right to breathe depends on money. In wealthy Europe and North America, hospitals treat oxygen as a fundamental need, much like water or electricity. It is delivered in liquid form by tanker truck and piped directly to the beds of coronavirus patients. Running short is all but unthinkable for a resource that can literally be pulled from the air. But in poor countries from Peru to Bangladesh, it is in lethally short supply. Across sub-Saharan Africa, oxygen is a costly challenge for government-funded medical facilities such as Guinea's Donka Public Hospital in the capital of Conakry. The hospital's planned oxygen plant has never started up, so instead of piping oxygen directly to beds, a second-hand pickup truck carries cylinders over potholed roads from Guinea's sole source of medical-grade oxygen, a factory dating to the 1950s. Outside the capital, in hospitals and medical centers in remote villages and major towns, doctors say there is no oxygen at all. Oxygen is one of the most important interventions, but it is in very short supply, said Dr. Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC and current president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives. In Bangladesh, the lack of centralized system for the delivery of oxygen to hospitals has led to a flourishing market in the sale of cylinders to homes. In Peru, the president has ordered industrial plants to ramp up production for medical use or buy oxygen from abroad. He allocated about $28 million for oxygen tanks and new plants. But a massive production increase or an impromptu private marketplace are both out of reach in Guinea, where GDP per capita is $850. A telecommunications engineer and U.S. resident who split his time between the Atlanta suburbs and his homeland boarded a flight to Guinea in February. He promised his wife and young daughters he'd be home by April to celebrate Ramadan. Then he fell ill. On May 4th, struggling to breathe and awaiting results for a coronavirus test, he was turned away from two medical facilities that said they weren't equipped to help. Finally, his brother-in-law drove him through curfew checkpoints to Donka Hospital, where he finally got the oxygen he had sought all day. It was apparently too little and too late. Within hours, he was dead. 6 weeks later, his coronavirus tests came back positive. His death sparked a furor in Guinea, prompting denials from the health minister that he had received anything except the best care. His widow, Taibu, said she can accept her husband's death as God's will, but said she cannot accept a medical system that failed. One life is not worth more than another, she said from her home in suburban Atlanta. Dr. Abubakar Konte, head of Guinea's health services, said four hospitals in outlying cities will eventually get their own InSight plants to ease what he acknowledged is a need for oxygen outside the capital. Only two have funding so far. Konte, who was diagnosed with coronavirus and hospitalized briefly at Dhaka himself, was philosophical about the gap between wealthy nations and those like Guinea. Technology comes gradually, he said. For many severe COVID patients, hypoxia, radically low blood oxygen levels, is the main danger. Only pure oxygen in large quantities buys the time they need to recover. Oxygen is also used for the treatment of respiratory diseases such as pneumonia, the single largest cause of death in children worldwide. Yet, until 2017, oxygen wasn't even on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. In vast parts of sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and Asia, that meant there was little money from international donors and little pressure on governments. Oxygen has been missing on the global agenda for decades, said Leith Greenslade, a global health activist with the coalition Every Breath Counts. The issue got more attention after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson narrowly survived coronavirus, crediting his recovery to the National Health Service and leaders of oxygen. But Johnson is a prominent figure in one of the world's wealthiest countries. Unlike for vaccines, clean water, contraception, or HIV medication, there are no global studies to show how many people lack oxygen treatment, only broad estimates that suggest at least half of the world's population does not have access to it. Doctors outside Conakry said oxygen is just another necessity they do without, joining basic painkillers, thermometers, and reliable electricity on a long list. All we can do is send someone elsewhere if they are in need, said Dr. Gato Memnenomo of Sanagardi Community Hospital. In mid-June, at least two people tested positive for COVID-19 there. One was driven more than 6 hours by ambulance, according to the mayor, Mamadou Ba. Guinea's official coronavirus tally is more than 4,988 coronavirus cases and 27 dead. The tally is an undercount as testing is limited. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Up next, we'll give a shout out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for listening.